And I want to see if I can elaborate, because it seems, I was trying to participate in writing a book with a bunch of guys, and I sat down, all I could think of was sea stories, you know. No strategic overviews, no this, that, and the other. I said, well, you know, then I did this, and I saw that guy, everything was fine. And I said, I don't know, I wouldn't want to read this. So I just dropped out of the project. It's still going on. There have been a lot of people who are doing it. It's Harvey Nice and John O'Donnell are putting the book together. It was inspired by this lump of shit from McNamara. I said there weren't anybody around that that knew anything about Vietnam. Well, there are a lot of people didn't hear that.
Yeah,
we never had a military buildup. We would never have had a military buildup if anybody had ever listened to people who knew Vietnam.
Right.
Anyway.
No, it was probably the worst thing that was done.
Yeah, well, that was you know, our particular, we'll call it a group. It was much too loose and associated with people. Don't bring in combat troops. The Vietnamese,
they just fought their hearts out to get rid of the French, and what the hell are you
exactly
doing?
And, you know, the Chinese for 1,000 years before them, and it was just,
right,
you know, no foreign invaders, please.
Yeah. Advisors, okay.
Yeah.
In limited numbers.
Sure.
Keep them very quiet.
Right.
Keep them out of the field.
Right. That's right.
That's right. Work individually with people.
Had an underemployed military on our side, a guy like McNamara who believed in the tenets of modern industrial society, which simply did not wash in that kind of cultural environment. Anyway, I resigned from, as you said, went to work for a community development counseling service, spent 3 years in northern Thailand. There were a bunch of other ex-IVSs with us in Thailand and some in Laos at the time. Left them and started working in Africa in 19. Then went back to IVS, worked on staff for IVS.
Yes, you mentioned that, 72, 74.
Originally, the idea was that I was going to do consulting and work part-time for IVS, and finally that sort of ended up taking the whole.
The IVS side took everything,
yes.
Huh?
Yeah. And then.
What did you do for IVS?
It was program development. So trying
based
to
in Washington, or
based? Yes, based in Washington,
okay.
Trying to organize research and so on for new programs. And I didn't get along with Tony Lake when he came on board, and so I left and started doing consulting and contracting work for the USAID Africa Bureau in the post-drought period, and ended up spending the last 20 years in Africa. Ultimately rejoining the USAID.
So you were on staff then after the program in Vietnam was already phased out.
See, I sort of joined, that's was 72. No, we had, I think Daddy Whitfield had, I can't remember the actual year when aid terminated the contract.
With IVS. Yeah, I think it was 71. There might have been a couple of people still left in.
Well, that's right. Must have been, because John Howard was the controller at the USAID office, and he had helped close out the books, etc., on the IVS contract in Vietnam. Sure, they had left.
Yeah. So your work in those 2 years, or 2 years or less, how much of it related to picking up the pieces in Vietnam after, or anything with Laos?
No, nothing.
Okay, all right.
Except, you know, in Laos we were going to funerals.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, I always kept my close connections with IVS when I was working for USAID in Washington. Peter Hunting's funeral and others. That and also orienting people. And I remember Gittleson. Particularly, I was coming up sort of selling the party line, which was USAID's line, and well, basically you know, the government in Vietnam was no great shakes, but you're there to try to give people an alternative. And I always felt at the time that we chose means to support a valuable end, which were absolutely impossible to achieve that end. But it was not a moral question, in my view. It was just that it's the stupidest end that you're absolutely guaranteed not to, to do this. And getting, you know, pretty stiff questioning from people like Dave. And that was the beginning of the big policy, big debate. I ended up, you know, sort of pro, and then later saw this belief in the mass scheme and sort of kind of just got out of it, so to speak, and then turned my attention elsewhere. A good friend of mine, Bob Brown, was quite active in the anti-war movement. Does that ring a bell?
No.
He was a program officer in Vietnam, a black American.
Bob Brown?
Yeah. And he was...
Is he still around?
He was at Howard. He had
really?
Some sort of sinecure at Howard several years ago. He was a, the U.S. U.S. Under Carter. He was a U.S. He knows quite a lot about IBS, too, by the way.
Well, if he was a program officer, he should.
In Saigon.
Yeah.
He was assistant program officer. He was in the program office.
Mm-hmm.
But we were personal friends, and he knew a lot of the IBS boys. And then in the Carter administration, he was a U.S. delegate to the African Development Bank. And good guy. Well, I don't know. Why don't you go hit what we haven't covered in any...
Yeah, I just had a couple of things.
Two of my three children were born in Vietnam.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Teach them any Vietnamese?
Oh, they learned it.
They did.
But they've, and we used to converse when we didn't want other people to know about it, but they've all forgotten it since.
Yeah, yeah. I had four things that I wrote down, and I'm looking at the first one now. You said somewhere that there was a rebellion with AID that you, quote, almost fomented. I think, unless I didn't read your handwriting right.
It was this period that I mentioned when we were at sort of loose ends, not knowing what to do. We wrote some sort of, you know, since we're not getting paid, job satisfaction is our most important requirement. And you're, you know, you wicked and stupid people are not, you know, making it possible for us to have any job satisfaction. I mean, it was a sort of a letter that we all wrote and signed and sent to, I forget, it was the mission director or something, but it was intercepted by the aforesaid Howard Harper and managed to, you know, he didn't stop it from going through, but managed to condition it and so on. So get these jerks out of here, you know. And that was, must have been 19... So maybe the tail end of 57 or early 58.
So it was all about your 1 year into it.
Yes.
Yeah.
When we were obviously, you know.
Still floundering.
Yes.
And before you were picked up for the ag program?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
And, you know, we took this high moral tone, which your young people are often inclined to take.
Yeah. Not having anything else.
That's right. You're a pig, you've got two cars at any time. Can't possibly.
Okay, I wondered what that what that reference was.
Yeah, that was it. But I was among several, and I was a very sharp-tongued.
Oh, well, that's nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. Okay, so that was the first thing that I had written down. The second one was about the date discrepancy, with, you know, you being in the first team, but and we clarified that when we were talking. One thing that you mentioned that spoke very highly. I knew all of the great old men at the, or of the IVS boards.
That's true.
And I'd really like to get your impression and remembrances of some of the original leaders.
Sure, Stanley Andrews, Snyder of the Mennonites, call them the Mennonite Monsignor O'Rourke, the Catholic Bishops Council.
Okay.
Dale Clark, who turned into sort of a doddering old guy later. Lou Hoskins, who's a Quaker professor from high school, he's still on board emeritus now. I mean, people of weight and moral orientation, not self-seekers. That this is my recollection of them.
Yeah, no, no, no. This is what
and
I want. Yeah.
It was just a terribly impressive group of people. Now, these are the people who were on the board, you know, certainly during the time that I was a volunteer and quite a number of years after, at least some were on the board.
Until approximately when?
Well, I think the major change that occurred, and I say this as a Democrat, supports the party and so on, is when IVS was, and this was after it had been, I think, seriously divided on the Vietnam issue, Vietnam policy issue.
So about 66, 67 maybe?
Yeah, things were beginning, you know, to, because nothing happened abruptly, it was sort of incremental.
No, no, all change
yes.
doesn't happen
right.
like with a snap of a finger.
But it then became sort of a bolt hole for the senior unemployed Democrats on the board. Nicholas Katzenbach. I mean, now some of these were extremely, you know, good fellows and so
yeah,
on.
Yeah, yeah. But that doesn't mean all of them were.
No, that wasn't mean all of them were. And I thought it was, you know, it had left its moorings. And became a thing to do by people who had, you know, a lot of other things that they were interested in. And surely, you know, the Mennonite Pope had a lot of other fish to fry, but somehow you got the impression that he was there, you know, full time when he was doing it full time. It wasn't clear. And that included guys like Dick Holbrooke and Tony Lake, Katzenbach, Paul Warnke, and so on. And again, you know, sort of in a political spectrum, many were very admirable characters, but it offended my notion of IVS as basically a simple organization, you know, with a lot of dirty boots tradition. And in fact, I never thought it was a good idea for us to get an English teaching in Vietnam when we went from 20 odd, you know, to suddenly 50. This was part of this mass approach to things that was happening on a much larger scale in Vietnam. You know. It brought in some very interesting people who would not otherwise have been there. You know, once you branched out of this Cal College conscience objector kind of thing. You know, I've sort of been a contrarian for a long time, and I just wanted to use English teachers in order to do that. And that was also coincident with a major increase in size. And then later it was mainly the probably more thoughtful, you know, English teacher types, etc., who became much more engaged in the political rights and wrongs of the war. The dirty boots guys was, we're got to fix that tractor. You know, we're not not involved very much in that. Too much taking what they were otherwise doing.
And this coincided with the switch around in the board too.
No, that was. I couldn't trace the actual sequencing.
Okay.
But it had to do with Nixon coming in. That put the Democrats out of a job. They went to their different roosts, the Carnegie Institute.
So the English teachers did precede this. Because
I
think the English teachers
debate
kind of started coming
in. The debate
in
was lively, you know. And I call them English teachers, but that's not fair, because it was a broader thing. It was, at any rate, people who had left the old
agricultural program and rural development.
Yeah.
End of the work.
No, that's very. It's a very clear cleavage, and, mm-hmm. and both mm-hmm. Mark and I have discussed that.
You fix that up, yeah.
Yeah, I mean it's very clear, you know, in terms of attitudes of
mm-hmm.
Not only. I think at a certain point in time, whether they were agriculture or English teachers, to use the English teacher thing, all became anti-war in a sense.
Right.
But in terms of job satisfaction, clearly job satisfaction
right.
was much higher among the Aggies.
Oh, yeah.
The CD folks and the construction
right, right,
people.
Right, right,
and
right. Well, I'd say it was your Peace Corps experience, too.
I mean, I felt so glad. I mean, this, again, is more about me, but I felt so glad that I'm going to pause it, actually, put this back on again, because I told my story about
okay.
myself, so
right.
I'll put the tape on.
This question, you know, I had the very good fortune, I think, of being close to the Peace Corps team in Burkina Faso.
Oh, uh-huh, yeah.
You know, from 1974, when we first
mm-hmm.
went there in this design mission, in effect, and built a mission there. And it was a remarkable group of Peace Corps volunteers,
mm-hmm.
in good part because they were looking for alternatives to the draft because they were against the war. So
mm-hmm.
you had you sort of more mature kids, in a sense, they were making decisions about what they wanted to do, and very talented, very charming. And then seeing that through my days there, which ran until 59, 4.5 years, and then coming back in 92, at a time when the Peace Corps was just now re-entering
uh-huh.
Burkina Faso. And I was instrumental in the negotiations to get the Peace Corps into Cape Verde, in the sense that I was the chargé, and I had to deal with the government during the time. It was just a sort of legalistic...
Yeah.
Rubbish.
That goes along with everything.
Yeah. So I've had, experience of volunteer type things by being part of it and also
mm-hmm.
being beside or in helping it to get going.
An administrative facilitator.
Mm-hmm. I guess. Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
No, more than that. You know,
yeah.
close friends. I mean.
Yeah, as well as
yeah,
as
sure.
the personal side too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we covered that.
Yeah.
Okay, and let's see. So there was the two I've asked you, the one that we covered during the thing. The final thing was not part of the IVS experience per se. It comes after.
Mm-hmm.
But you're still in Vietnam, and it would be what your impressions were of Nguyen Ngoc Diem. And the period running up to his assassination.
Yeah.
Which has been something that has always fascinated me.
Right.
Because I see that as an incredibly important
yeah.
period.
I think it was. During the time that I got there, which was 57 until I left in 1963.
Yeah, you said just before the coup.
Just before the coup.
Mm-hmm.
There was, I never knew anybody who really had a very high opinion
mm-hmm.
of him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they thought it was, you know, a minor sins like just too pompous. But the ones, Americans who were there early on, you know, including Rufus Phillips and company, who were there, in effect, when what was South Vietnam was being built around one man who had courage and was steadfast.
Yeah.
He was a pain in the ass, you know.
Yeah.
And their sense of him was so much different and so much better, but we found him distant. And even among northern refugees, they had a bad name for him. They called him Kukai, which means, I don't know, castrated sweet potato or something wicked like that. but there was not somebody that I appreciated personally
mm-hmm.
from him or his works.
Do you ever have a chance to meet him?
I sat in on a major meeting with his brother, who he knew,
mm-hmm.
and in fact took the notes on that, simply because I wasn't close enough to participate in the, I think this was in the old Office of Rural Affairs. And he was just, you know, a pretty slimy guy.
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, they should have had a red carpet out. They were done badly by the generals, their assassination.
Oh, you mean a red carpet to get him out of the country to Switzerland and go someplace.
Diem did nothing that bad to deserve that fate.
Right.
I mean, even the Kun Lao were, you know, partly in the competition with the people like the Bing Xuyen or certainly the elements of the Viet Cong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And through the whole thing, I never thought the Viet Cong were nice guys at all.
Mm-hmm.
They just were more able.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, this is a point of difference I have with Don from, you know, ever since, Don Luce, ever since that time.
Mm-hmm.
No, I was not a fan of Diem, and it was not on very solid grounds, just impressions and so on. I mean, he was not, there were certainly loyalists, you know, the clergy,
uh-huh,
the refugees.
Yes.
And so on, and they had seen the other side of the coin, you know, the absence of this when they came south. I couldn't. It seemed like all enthusiasm for him was carefully drummed up and orchestrated. Now that happens to every person. I also conceived an immense dislike for Lyndon Johnson. He came through as vice president. I was one of his interpreters.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I don't actively dislike Ngo Dinh-Diem, but I actively dislike Lyndon Johnson.
Oh, really? What did he do?
Oh, jeez. He was on this, you know, circuses, well, there's certain things really amazing about him, certainly. But he was, I was interpreting the time he was talking to a young province chief, military officer, major, who was so proud of the work he was doing and was going on and waxing enthusiastic about it. And you know, he called all his interpreters boy. And a couple were, you know, at least mid-ranking embassy officers. What we called boy. Interpreter, boy. But that was the least troublesome. What was really troublesome to me was this province chief thought he was really engaged in a conversation with
him. Yes.
And then there was a smart Chinaman named Jen, Chinese-American, who had set up a cotton spinning and weaving mill. And he had these bales of cotton in the background. So there's a factory in Vietnam signed Texas Cotton. And there was a clack of newsmen around.
Mm-hmm.
And Johnson's perfect. So suddenly, Johnson starts playing off this poor bugger to the press corps. And this guy still thinks that he's having a conversation with the president, and suddenly he's getting these non sequitur answers. It's nothing to do with the, you know, the question that was asked and so on, but it's just bouncing off this guy to the press corps. And he realized what's going on. He turned absolutely red, furious.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been deceived.
Yeah.
And, you know, couldn't very well say anything about it and so on. But, you know, it's sort of an illness highly public figures get. I mean, they you know, they don't talk like you and I talk
mm-hmm.
right now. They're,
mm-hmm.
they're just, everything is an agenda and everything is played off the back wall. But just watching this poor guy going into it with such enthusiasm, you know. And
if only Johnson had just calm down for a minute, listen to him, he might have learned something, or at least he would have behaved better.
Yeah, that's right. I did get my revenge on that one. Johnson started saying that the vice president of Vietnam was a very decent man named Nguyen Van Tho, and the vice president of the United States, bosom buddies. Okay. When I learned my Vietnamese, it was in the village.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had a close friend, it was a Ban Co. That means you would exchange underwear with him.
Mm-hmm.
Freely translated, you might say, asshole buddy.
Okay.
And so I translated that into Vietnamese as the Vice President of the United States, Vice President of Vietnam, my asshole buddies, and the President John F. Kennedy and Ngo Dinh Diem are asshole buddies. And I saw this rank of Vietnamese in front of me. including.
But they all knew what you were saying.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't do it on purpose. It was just that was the word that I knew for close friend.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
You know, sort of the fruits of a certain kind of education. And so they kept...
It's that country bumpkin showing through.
Very good.
Yeah, no, I'd like to. I know Roof and some of the people who were there in the early 50s,
mm-hmm.
mid 50s. You know, had some appreciation of Ngo Dinh Diem. That I can't think of anybody on the American side who really had any. You know, really. I mean, there were political reasons for dealing with him.
You had to. And so you always kept up the PR. But certainly, yeah. I mean, as I said, I've read through a lot of the State Department transcripts and such.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was a genuine feel
that
this was going to be another McSisai.
Early on.
Yeah.
Yes.
And one thing I picked up, and I don't know that anyone has really, is one unsuccessful assassination attempt on Diem.
Oh, and Ben Mitchuk when we were there.
I think earlier.
Uh-huh.
A little bit earlier. I may be wrong. I'd have to check my notes.
Well, this...
And after that, a lot of the State Department memos were saying that Diem is starting to turn inward. He's a little afraid, you know, that this attempt really upset him and really, you know, shook his confidence in himself and in reaching out to the people. And in the viability of reform,
well, there
without
was,
necessarily saying all those things.
There was one that occurred
clearly.
Either during the time that we were in this refugee village or just before.
Mm-hmm.
And a man was killed. It was in fact, he was the father of a Vietnamese woman who was the wife of the son of Chon Van Don, General Chon Van Don, who was working in West Africa in Abidjan.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking to IBS people, I think, about turkeys. Now, that was the second visit, but they were so close together. I can't think if it was the same time or, you know, subsequent time. And I think it probably was the same time. Because I remember there was a big to-do about it in the village that somebody...
Oh, certainly in the village. Yeah. Wherever it happened, it would have.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I just remember this, and it seemed to be so clear and so subtle.
Mm-hmm.
But you had to be looking for something to really understand what
was
going on.
I mean, he was one of his brother, the cardinal,
mm-hmm.
said, you know, the church was too worldly for Ngo Dinh Diem.
Mm-hmm.
Had you heard that one?
No, I hadn't. But I can appreciate it. Yeah. So I've often wondered, you know, what would have happened had that assassination attempt not gone on, you know, if he'd been handled.
If he had been as he seemed to be.
To Lansdale, to Bohannon,
right.
to all the other
That's
people,
right.
including
right.
the juice mod kind of people.
Right.
You know, what might have happened? I mean, to some extent, it's useless speculation, but it's interesting speculation, too.
You know, historians do, right?
No. I bad ones try to do speculation.
To factoids, right?
Yeah. And getting the story straight.
During the time prior to the coup, we were all sort of taking everybody's temperature, the ones that were in our office, the ones we worked with. And
mm-hmm.
the fellow was director general of budget and foreign aid, sort of wonderful little guy named Sugar Tone. Someone told him he used to run the sugar mill. And he said, well, even in North Vietnam, the Buddhists did not burn themselves.
Yeah.
And that was my little vote on the table about, you know, what we should do about presidents, you know.
Yeah.
Well, people always accepted him. You know, he was an incidental villain, but, and, you know, the banality and profound self-interest was always put at the foot of his brother.
And Madame.
And, oh, yes, Madame. Yeah,
yeah, her wonderful comments about Brutus barbecues mm-hmm. and such. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No,
You know, I really steered clear of any of the writings on Vietnam.
Mm.
I think what I did was, I sort of got a fish hook in me, and it calloused around, and as long as you didn't bump into anything,
mm-hmm.
it didn't hurt.
Yeah.
And certainly, for many years, all this stuff would come streaming off the presses, one person or another person. I just never read it.
There's a lot of garbage.
Well, I'm sure. The thing that, of the things you can't escape, the popular media, the thing that came captured it mostly for me was Good Morning Vietnam. I mean, Platoon was fine, but it wasn't really about Vietnam.
Right, no, it wasn't.
Yeah, and Acropolis
was... Yeah, Acropolis was just a fantasy. Platoon was more like guys at war in almost
yes.
any situation.
Exactly.
Because
yeah.
you talk
yeah.
to vets from World War II that I grew up
yeah.
around,
yeah.
and a lot of their stories are not that much different. And I remember seeing, it wasn't a relative of mine, but it was a relative of someone else. You know, you always have somebody you call uncle who isn't
sure.
a yeah, relative uncle, of his, yeah. you know, and there was this guy like this, you know, in the corner, and post-traumatic stress.
Right.
you know?
Yeah.
Just not in Vietnam, but
that's right.
but early.
Called combat fatigue or
yeah,
shell shock.
Shell shock, they call it.
Deerslayer was a wonderful movie, but the best parts of it were about Pennsylvania steel towns, not about the
not about the silly
the
Russian roulette.
It. Yes, that's
bullshit.
Right.
You know that
right.
was just that almost got racist.
Yeah,
in the way it was portrayed.
But the best part of that was the. Coal Town, Seal Town.
Oh yeah, that was wonderful.
Yeah.
The ethnic portrayal. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I can't think of anything more to say.
I can't think of anything either, but I have enjoyed just chatting too.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, whether the tangents as well as on the marks.
Yeah. Yes, right.
So.
Well, you know, here I was, I started this, I said, yes, I'll write a piece here, my own experience. For this book. And mm-hmm. I sat down four pages and I said, all these sea stories in it. Is anybody interested? And they found when they were trying to assemble the other material, it was too much of an attempt. Maybe I should have gone on with the sea story thing. It would have been better. I mean, some were highly personal accounts, and others were telling about wonderful things I did before. And then,
mm-hmm.
anyway.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
They also Sterve, who only stand and wait is in it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Paul, the same. I sure wish we could get this thing out. How long do you think it's going to take to...
Let me turn this thing off. Bye.